Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Raise the Standard. This is Kim Kennedy, along with Michael and Gene Rapp of Brandywine Flags, local owners of Brandywine Flags, great patriots, serving their community as committee man and committee woman. And we're so excited to have them here with this new program. I'm going to turn it over to Michael at this point. He's going to do a segment on flags and their meaning. And Michael, what do you have on tap for today?
Well, not a better place than right here in Valley Forge that we would begin our journey on learning about the flag and where did it come from? How did we acquire this flag? And why does it look the way it does? There's an evolution. And I'm going to talk about seven different flags today, three of which are British, four of which are from here in the colonies. And I'm going to begin with St. George's Cross. St. George's Cross is a white flag with a red cross. And it came here with John Cabot in 1497. It's a British flag, and it was under the reign of King Henry the Seventh. Shortly after that, it's 1620. We're going to jump ahead to the Mayflower. Actually, there's a King James took the St. George's cross, and he put superimposed the St. Andrew's cross on top of that. And the name of that flag is the King's Colors. Folks may be familiar with that and the fact that it is now the Union Jack. So with that, we have a red, white, and blue flag beginning with the King's Colors. And going forward from there, during the colonization, Queen Anne in 1707 designed a flag called the British Red Ensign. The British Red Ensign is actually a red flag, and we now have the King's Colors in the field in the upper left. So that we have three British flags that started out in the red, white, and blue segment, and we're continuing with that on through to Taunton, Massachusetts. And in Taunton, Massachusetts, the colonists wanted to disrespect the British Red Ensign, and they put the words Liberty and Union on there. So that we have a British Red Ensign with the words Liberty and Union as kind of way to signify their dissatisfaction with the mother country, England. And this was a major step forward.
Yvonne? Can I ask you?
Sure.
How were these flags received by the British? What was their response to them?
Well, the British obviously were occupying the colonies, and the colonists, we knew that there was a problem. The next flag that I'm going to speak of is the Continental flag. And that's really when it all began. Listen, my children, you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April of 75. It was April 18th of 1775 when Paul Revere rode from Boston to Lexington. He didn't make it all the way to Lexington, but he was warning people and the militia to be prepared that the very first shot of the Revolutionary War was fired at Lexington. And the Continental flag is a red flag. It's similar to the British Red Ensign in the fact that it's red, but in the upper left, they removed the King's colors and they put in a green pine tree. And that particular flag flew for an extended period of time during this time. So how was it received? Obviously, it wasn't received very well by the British at this point because now the war had really begun with that very first shot. And it was difficult. I mean, here you're looking at the most powerful army in the world, that of the British regulars. And
Are you saying they weren't used to being defied and so openly with a flag?
They weren't used to being defied. And obviously, by a bunch of common farmers and shop owners and whatever, it's like I don't know that they took it really seriously that this was a significant threat. And when you look at how everything evolved, there was a lot that really happened here. So when we look at the flag, you know, it's a piece of material, but it's not really it's a fabric, but it's the fabric of our being. And it's how did we evolve into the country that we are and the respect that is shown. One of the problems that we have is the fact that this is not really taught in school anymore. There's revisionist history that we need to tell our children and our grandchildren what is the meaning of this. Because when you look at the Continental Flag, that was a significant endeavor here, whereby the farmers and the shop owners stood up to the largest army in the world.
And these flags served as a rallying, much like flags do today. They're a rallying point, like, you know, the Star-Spangled Banner was still standing. It made it, and it was an inspiration and an encouragement that people said, "Yeah, this is a, you know, a point where we can rally around and continue the fight, regardless."
That's true. And when you look at any kind of a military endeavor, when the flag of your foe has been replaced by your flag, and all persons can see it, they know that they have succeeded. So it is now a focal point to say, we've done this. We've achieved our objective. We've taken this particular hill, or we've taken a town or a city or what have you. And it's significant in the morale of those people to know that you're not doing this in vain. Mm. Also, the Continental Flag flew in Boston, and there was a battle known as the Battle of Bunker Hill. Okay, the British were in the Boston Harbor, and for whatever reason, the colonists they decided that they were going to fortify both Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill. And even though the British were successful in driving the colonists off of the hill and defeating them at that point, it was viewed as a moral victory because there were three assaults on Bunker Hill, and the colonists were successful in repelling the British on the first two. They had to retreat at the time of the third assault because they ran out of ammunition. So it was not thought to be a defeat. It was more to be thought of as a time of engagement where you were going to live to fight another day, where you had to retreat. So in order to commemorate that battle, there was a special flag design called the Bunker Hill flag. And it's really kind of neat that here you have the Continental flag is all red with a pine tree in a white area in the field in the upper left. And now the Bunker Hill flag, they changed from red to blue. They then superimposed the British or the St. George's Cross in the upper left, and in one of the segments of the St. George's Cross, they put the pine tree. So here you have the Bunker Hill flag is kind of a combination of several. So it's the evolution of that particular flag was a combination of several others as they were designed.
Michael, what did the changes signify? Why were they changed? What was the reason for that?
The Bunker Hill flag was to commemorate the fact that the colonists were successful, and this was a victory. This was a moral victory as opposed to a military victory because they were able to defeat the British on two assaults, and on the third, only because they were out of ammunition, is why they had to physically retreat. So the moral victory here was we are able to withstand the forces of the British. And we can move this forward, and it gave them great inspiration to continue, because you look at the war began on the 18th of April of 75, and then we move from there up to October 19th. 6 years later is when Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown. So this was a 6-year, 6-month endeavor in order to bring us from the point of the first shot at Lexington up until we defeated Cornwallis at Lexington.
It almost sounds like you're telling me that the flags reflected, they were like a history teller of what was happening, recording what was happening through the war and how the turn of events was going to communicate to people, this is the results, this is the outcome, this is where we're at now. Would that be a correct analysis?
I would say that's a good analogy. In the fact that you have a progression during the course of time, and each flag had a specific meaning for a specific time and place. And as you evolved, and again, it's an evolution of the flag. It's an evolution of the country. It's an evolution of our society as we see it, and it was moving forward. So I say that you're absolutely correct on that. The last flag that I'm going to speak on today is the Grand Union flag. And in 1776, the colonies adopted 13 stripes, and they now place the king's colors in the upper left, which is a combination of red and white stripes for the flag, and then in the field is the combination of St. Andrew's Cross and St. George's Cross, or the Union Jack in the upper left. So here we now have come to a point whereby we have done a full evolution, if you will, from the beginning using all the components of all the different flags to this point to make now a new flag that is known as the Grand Union. It's also known as Washington's flag or the Cambridge flag. So it was really great.
Very, very interesting. Looking forward to hearing another session of Flag in our next episode. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
This week is the 70th anniversary of the liberation by the Russians of Auschwitz. And, however, anti-Semitism in Europe is once again on the rise, and it's rearing its ugly head. Israel is fighting for her life, having been surrounded by her enemies on all four sides. Now President Obama has made it clear that he has disdain for Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the Israeli people themselves, even though they are our biggest allies in the Middle East. And John Boehner has invited Benjamin Netanyahu to speak before the Congress in March, and Obama will not see a Netanyahu when he is here for his visit. The State Department is actively working to support a Netanyahu's opponent in Israel for the upcoming elections, and that is just unacceptable. And when Obama won the 2012 election, Valerie Jarrett said, "We will punish our enemies and we will reward our friends." This is a perfect example of them doing exactly that. And it's entirely possible that we will see another Holocaust in our time. However, now it will include infidels, which are us, Christians, and anyone that does not adhere to the tenets of Islam. And I think we should all keep that in mind. It's a big problem.
Actually, I think it's happening now. When you look at what is happening to Christians across the world, that they're being persecuted, they're being beheaded, they're being crucified. This is just the forerunner. When Hitler had the death camps, he did this in a confined area in the various camps, Dachau, Auschwitz, what have you. But now we see it in villages and towns all over the world that there is persecution.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that also to the attention of our listeners and to the public, because that is something that you don't hear in the mainstream media. Welcome back to Raise the Standard. I'm Kim Kennedy, along with Michael and Jean Rapp, the hosts of our program, owners of Brandywine Flags in Exton, extraordinary historians. We want to pick up the conversation here with Jean. Jean has been doing a lot of research and following very closely the story of Pastor Saeed, who is currently imprisoned in Iran. And Jean, can you shed some more light on this subject for our listeners? I'm sure many of them aren't aware of him and what he's been going through.
Certainly. One of the reasons that people are not aware of this is because the liberal media has not been covering it. But Pastor Saeed Abedini is 35 years old, and he's an Iranian-American Christian pastor. And he's been imprisoned in Iran since the summer of 2012. His wife, Negme, his daughter, Rebecca, who was 9, his son, Jacob, who was 6, live in Boise, Idaho. He has been imprisoned in Evin Prison in Tehran, Iran, and also Rajeh Sher Prison in Karaj, Iran. In 2000, Saeed converted to Christianity and started house churches in Iran. And then in 2002, he met Negme in Tehran, and in 2004, they married. They left for America in 2005, where Negme lived since she had been in the fourth grade. In 2009, Saeed and his family returned to Iran. He was arrested in the airport. He made an agreement with the authorities to cease all home church activities, and they would allow him to come and go freely. The government encouraged Saeed to do humanitarian efforts like creating orphanages. Then in March of 2010, he became a naturalized citizen by marriage. From 2009 to 2012, he traveled to Iran 8 times to build government-approved orphanages in Iran. And in 2012, Nagmeh and the kids visited Iran with Saeed to work on an orphanage. In 2012, in July, he went to Iran to approve final board members for the orphanage. Later in July, Iranian Revolutionary Guard took Saeed off his bus, and it was just days before he was planning to leave for the U.S., and he was interrogated and put under house arrest at his parents' home in Tehran. Later in July, Nagmeh retains American Center for Law and Justice, which was known as ACLJ, a constitutional and human rights organization. She retained them to help with this problem with Saeed and get him freed. And the ACLJ, in case you're not familiar with that, it's Jay Sekulow. You may have seen him on some of the news programs on Fox and whatever. And he is very active in helping people who are trapped in other countries and so forth.
Jean, can I interrupt you for a second? I'm just curious. What, if anything, is our government doing to help this man? Or is that, am I jumping the gun there?
Well, I was just about to get to that. Anyway, the ACLJ notified the State Department regarding Saeed. And Nagmeh was told by the State Department that there's nothing they could do but monitor the situation. So 5 Iranian regimented guards raided the Abedini home where his family lived and where he was staying, and they took him to Evin prison, where he is was in solitary confinement for 4 weeks. His family did not even know where he was for the first 4 days. He was allowed to meet with his Iranian lawyer one time only, and that was 24 hours before his trial. His trial was held by Judge Abbas Par Abbasi, a revolutionary court jurist who has been sanctioned by the European Union for human rights abuses. U.S. government, through Natural Security Council, publicly demanded Saeed's release in January of 2013. And 174 days after his initial arrest on charges related to his Christian faith. He is convicted of undermining national security for working Christian house churches between 2000 and 2006, and he was condemned to 8 years in Evin prison. Saeed tells his family he is bleeding internally and due to beatings and torture. His family learns 3 doctors visited Saeed, and he needs to be hospitalized for internal bleeding. Then the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, issued the first public statement calling for Saeed's release. Then Saeed was taken to Madras, a private hospital near Evin, but no doctor was present to treat him, and that day he was beaten again. He complains of blood in his stool, intense abdominal pain, and frequent fainting spells. Then in April, he was put in solitary confinement.
Can I ask you, Jean, real quick, is there any pressure from international humanitarian groups on behalf of this man's case, is it just coming from the U.S.?
I'm getting to that. The White House calls on Iran to provide medical treatment and release him. Saeed's wife and attorneys from the ACLJ presented Saeed's case before the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva. And then he is taken to a hospital, and for the first time, he was examined by a physician and prescribed medications for his injuries that were sustained while he was in prison. He had a large internal wound with scar tissue in his digestive tract. John Kerry called on Iran to work to release Saeed and other Americans unjustly jailed in Iran. Nagmeh relays her disappointment that Obama has yet to speak publicly about Saeed's case. And then in September, prayer vigils in some 80 cities and 15 countries worldwide marked the 365 days of imprisonment for Saeed. European Parliament passed a resolution urging Iran to release Saeed. Saeed's Iranian family arrives at Evin prison only to be told he has been transferred to another prison, which is a deadly jail notorious for housing violent murderers and rapists. His health deteriorates. He's refused medicine and is robbed by fellow inmates at knife point. Then in November of 2013, the U.S. and other world powers reached a tentative agreement with Iran to freeze its nuclear program. Saeed's freedom is not even included in the agreement. The U.S. will, however, release a jailed Iranian nuclear scientist as part of the bargain. The ACLJ calls the deal an appalling betrayal of Pastor Saeed. And it goes on from there and so on and so forth. But then, again, on September 26th in 2014, worldwide prayer vigils marked the second anniversary of his imprisonment. And recently, Obama met with Pastor Saeed's wife and told her securing the pastor's release was a top priority. Well, he's still in there, and it doesn't look like he's going to be getting out anytime soon. And this is just an example of how this country doesn't care about their American citizens and when they find themselves in situations where they're imprisoned in another country. This is also very similar to the Sergeant Tamarisi, who was jailed in Mexico, and Obama and the government did very little to help him, and he was finally released.
And, you know, Gene, in spite of that, I've heard that he has led a lot of his fellow prisoners to the Lord. So God is getting glory out of the situation. And we just need to continue to pray for this man. And hopefully you'll keep us updated from time to time on his situation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, everyone. Welcome back again to yet another segment of Raise the Standard. And we're here with Michael and Gene Rapp of Brandywine Flags in Exton. Great historians, great politicians, I should say, too. They're committee man and committee woman in their area, serving their community. And today, on our next topic, we're going to be talking about preparedness. Michael, preparedness, what is that? What does it mean?
Well, Kim, in our first broadcast, I mentioned that we have a very wide range of customers. And one group is the first responder community. And it's incredible what we've learned from them and through them on preparedness. And when I look at it today, this is not an imagined problem. Currently, there are tens of thousands of people that are in real trouble in New England because of the snowstorm that came through this past week. I look at the island of Nantucket lost power, the entire island, 21,000 people. This is a problem because we're talking cold weather. Mm-hmm. We're talking
wind gusts.
It's a significant issue. And, you know, my question is, what do you want to prepare for? I mean, just a weather event, a simple snowstorm. I mean, it's January. It's February. It's the weather. It's something that we've lived with all along. And the question is, what can you do and where do you start? In order to be prepared, the first thing you have to do is identify what must you prepare for, what are your needs, and then develop a plan. I mean, this can happen to us. We've got 6 or 7 more weeks of potential weather problems.
And February usually is notorious for some big storms?
Yes. And now is the time to really think about this. The first thing you have to do is identify your specific needs. Each family is different. The size of the family, the age of the family, the health of the family. Do we have children? Do we have adults? Do we have elderly people? Do we have pets? The medical status of each person. We've come to rely on electricity, and that's the biggest issue I think that we've got going right now is the loss of power, the loss of electricity means that
pretty much shuts down a house, huh?
It shuts down everything. We rely on it for everything. Just think of something so simple as a person that's on oxygen and they have a unit that is run by electricity that will generate oxygen. What happens when you lose power? Do you have a backup bottle of oxygen for those situations? Just think about the most simple, and it's the details. It's not the giant problem. It's the details of your family needs with that. Do you have enough prescription medication on hand? Is there a problem there? Dialysis treatment. So many things that are affected by this. And the fact that we come to rely on electricity so much, and everyone's experienced this loss at some point in time. So what we need to do is, you know, what are the resources that you currently have, and what are your main concerns right now? I'm going to say that the main concern right now is heat. You will die from exposure much quicker than you will die from lack of food or water. So with that, you need to have some way to preserve the heat in your home or to generate the heat. Do you have an alternate source? Do you have wood or coal or propane space heater, what have you? If you heat your house with natural gas or propane, that's great. but you need electricity to run your furnace, to run the if it's fuel oil, you need to have electricity to run the burner motor. You need to have electricity to run the blower fan, and your furnace won't turn on unless you have that.
Sounds like you're saying that maybe every household should have a generator? Is that
well, that's probably not going to be possible, because you look at what if you're in an apartment and the apartment complex loses power. One of the things that we look at is developing a community of support within your local geographic area. People from your church, people from your community, people from whatever activities you engage in, to make a plan to say, if in fact there's a problem, when the heat goes off, that's not the time to go knocking on somebody's door. You need to have some way of developing support among yourselves, so that with that, a lot of folks, when there's a storm coming, the first thing they do is they go out and they buy a generator. Wow, we got a generator. What are you going to do with it? Is it hooked to your furnace? Is it the size you need? So you need to plan for that. Supposing you have sleep apnea, what do you do? Run your generator all night with sleep apnea? Well, now what do you do for fuel? You either have to be able to conserve your fuel or replenish it. If you live in Nantucket, there are no gas stations pumping fuel. You can't, and to make it worse, the weather situation is so bad that you can't even drive anywhere. I mean, what happens when the governor shuts down the state for two or three days? No one driving, excepting emergency vehicles. Now what do you do? So try and develop a plan and actually talk to your neighbors, get to know who they are, and try and find people of like mind that you can go to and say, you know, hey, I've got the following resources, and in the event of a problem, in the event of an emergency, what can you do? If you look at the situation of water, if you have public water, it's not a problem. If you have a well, now you've got a situation where unless you have electricity, you cannot get the water out of the ground. So this is a simple solution. Just store some water. You can store water for drinking and for sanitary use. Fill your bathtub. You can now use the bathtub to flush your toilets, to take a pitcher and just put water into your basin and wash your hands, what have you. So that you have heat, I think, is the main thing on how to conserve that. And then water going next, food. What do you do for food? I mean, I can't believe that when the word snow is in the forecast, the first thing people do is rush to the store and they buy eggs, bread, and milk, and they go home and they make French toast, I guess. So you look at the food side, just have a small pantry. You have canned goods, protein bars, snacks, juice, comfort foods. Think in terms of babies, children, adults, pets.
That's a great point. You're thinking about your pets. They're important, too.
Absolutely. Then how do you cook it? Okay, a propane or a charcoal grill. Do you have an extra tank of propane for your grill? You have maybe a small camping stove or maybe an open fire. Look for hand-operated utensils. What would you give for a hand-operated can opener in a power outage?
These are all very practical tips. I'm sitting here thinking, I didn't think about this.
It's mostly common sense, and just think about that. Refrigeration, right now, that's not a problem. if it were August, refrigeration would be an issue. But now...
bury it outside, right?
Just get a couple of cool... One of the problems that you may have is you may want to put it into a styrofoam cooler and put it outside for fear that your food would freeze. Mm. So that you may have the opposite effect by putting it all outside and it's 13 degrees. Mm. So look at refrigeration as not an issue. Lighting. Forget the flashlights. Batteries are going to go dead. Look for things like jar candles. I would not use open flame tapers. They're a little more dangerous, and they're going to run, and you're going to expire fairly quickly. But a jar candle, put it on a shelf and put a mirror behind it. It'll light the whole room. Kerosene lamps. How many people have outdoor solar lights in their garden?
Yes.
Bring them inside. You put one in the bathroom, one in the hallway, one at the top of the stairs. It's on all night. Next morning, you put it out on the porch, and it charges again and bring it in the next night.
That's silly.
There's so many people that have resources, but you don't think about it.
Yes.
What would you do for that? Look in terms of medicine. Have a really good first aid kit. I like to have a first aid kit that is above my pay grade because there are things in my first aid kit that I have no idea how to use them. But you know what? There might be a neighbor that does know how to use them. And they were to say, you know, if I had the following, I'd be able to help you. Well, hopefully we have the following in that first aid kit.
Really sounds like, Michael, that in these situations, regardless of the time of the year, what I hear you saying is hang together and we'll survive.
Yes. I mean, it's not that long that we've even had electricity. I mean, we go back to my grandparents did not even have electricity. But we've come to rely on so many other people to do things for us. It's crazy that we're no longer able to do things for ourselves.
Self-sufficiency.
Think in terms of games and activities for kids and adults alike. The biggest problem that your teenagers are going to have is that they're going to have to talk to you. They're no longer going to be texting because their electric components are not going to work.
Some good can come out of these situations, huh?
Yes, indeed. And there's no need to panic. Make it an adventure. Try and make this an indoor camping trip with your kids and keep everybody calm. But the big thing is to develop the network of support and reach out to other people. Being prepared is not difficult, and it's not expensive. You have more resources at your fingertips than you could ever imagine. Where we are here, we're very, very fortunate. I mean, could you imagine being in New York City living on the 45th floor of an apartment complex? Hopefully you wouldn't be the one caught in the elevator when the power goes out. And then what do you do? You're going to walk up and down 45 steps of steps, 45 flights of stairs to get in and out of your apartment. So it's mostly common sense, takes a little bit of planning, a little bit of forethought, and be prepared for the next snowstorm. It's on its way.
Michael, I hope that you'll put this list together and put it on your website. We can direct our listeners to it to find out more information.
Will do.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Welcome back, WFYL listeners. This is Kim Kennedy along with Michael and Jean Rapp from Brandywine Flags. They're the hosts of Raise the Standard, a program dedicated to preserving American history, teaching about it, talking about it, addressing veterans issues, and which is a great segue, Jean and Michael, into our next topic concerning some of the things that Representative Jeff Miller has been trying to address in Congress concerning veterans issues. Jean, can you bring us up to snuff on that?
Yes. This morning on Fox, I heard that Representative Jeff Miller, who is a representative from Florida, he's a member of the House Armed Services Committee and also the Committee on Veterans Affairs. He has come up with a bill to reform how bonuses are given out to the VA and also to recoup bonuses from those who withheld care and who manipulated data. The union is strongly condemning the VA bill. They don't want any parts of it.
Well, that's unfortunate, but I can't say I'm surprised.
No, I'm not surprised either. the people from the VA obviously don't care about the veterans. If they did, they would certainly be on board with this bill. But like many of the politicians, they are only concerned with themselves.
Michael?
You know, Kim, I think we've got to stop treating veterans as a priority. We have one top priority, then a new top priority. Priorities change. We need to treat them as a value because values never change. Whenever there's a new hot topic, that becomes the new top priority and something else takes a back seat. These veterans, I mean, as I said prior to this, that we do not have a better country because of our veterans. It's because of our veterans that we have a country.
That's right.
When you look at the sacrifice, all gave some and some gave all. You're looking at not just the veteran, but you're looking at the families of the veterans. And it's just it's so widespread that when there's a problem, it's a big problem. And you look at the health and the well-being of these men and women, And what they're allowing us to live the lives that we have because of what they did. And now we're going to piecemeal care, or we're going to piecemeal legislation. Why would we do that?
And, you know, Gene and Michael, in my mind, I think to myself, well, everybody knows that. That's a given. But it's not. Obviously, it's not. And these things need to be addressed, and these things need to be said, and they need to be said on a repeated basis. And to talk about cliches like freedom isn't free. And
got freedom, think of it.
Thank you. That's a great bumper sticker. But it's true. As someone has said, that freedom is the United States experiment in freedom is a parenthesis in world history. And maybe you guys can talk about that a little bit, about the uniqueness of our of what we have here, and why it's worth fighting for. And for those, like you said, for those who gave all, why it's worth it, and why it's worth honoring these veterans.
Well, I think that one thing that is crystal clear is we have people trying to get into this country, but we don't have a lot that are trying to get out. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of people trying to get into a lot of the other countries. So I think that speaks volumes.
I mean, even now as we speak, guys, there's people in the world now who are chopping people's heads off, going into buildings and blowing people up. And for what cause? Is that a cause worth dying for?
Well, it's a cause that will be coming to a theater near you if we don't wake up and do something about this and accept the reality of the Muslim terrorists and do something about them instead of just talking about it and making excuses for them.
Agreed.
Yeah, I look back at Ronald Reagan, and he once said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. Mm. We did not pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children what it was once like in the United States when men were free. How appropriate that is for today, that we're losing our direction. We're losing our focus. And it's not a good thing. We need to get back into the mainstream of focusing on who we are, the American spirit, and who we are as a country.
I think something else that people could do to help make a change would be write facts, email, whatever, and call these radio and television stations and networks and tell them that you are tired of them keeping things under wraps when it isn't good for Obama and only reporting things that they want us to hear. Because the people that do not watch Fox or listen to talk radio haven't got a clue what's going on. And they need to wake up and realize that they're not being told the truth and things are being hidden from them. And that's how the mainstream media keeps these people in disbelief, or whatever you want to call it, by not telling them the truth and telling them things that just absolutely aren't true. So I think that's something else people could do, is get on that phone or email or fax or whatever and contact your sponsors and the stations and networks and tell them you're tired of being lied to and you want to be told the truth.
Hey, Gene and Michael, what about, this is impromptu, they're looking at me like, well, what is she going to say next? But, you know, I'd like to say to you and for myself and our listeners that appreciate a veteran. Contact a local VFW. How can we show appreciation and gratitude? Take a tray of cookies. Invite them into your school to speak. And what are some other ideas you guys have that we could do to raise this awareness? And here, there, Gene, you've written a book, and I know that you're going to address that in future editions about local veterans and their stories. And what are your guys' ideas about that?
One of the greatest things you can do is when you're sitting in the diner having breakfast and you see a guy across the table or somewhere else in the diner that has scrambled eggs on his hat that says World War II vet or Vietnam vet, what have you, it's just call the waitress over and say, I'd like to pay for his breakfast.
Oh, that's great.
Don't tell anybody that I'm doing this. Don't tell him. And just say that there's a patron in the restaurant here that would like to say thank you for your service. When you see him jump up and look around and you just kind of keep eating your omelet and don't really make eye contact, it's fabulous to see. And then the smile that they'll have on their face. Mm-hmm. And it's the best $6 you can spend for the entire day to just say thank you.
That's what a great idea, you guys. That's
we've
really
done
wonderful.
That several times, and it is. It's amazing. It is amazing.
The other thing is when you approach somebody that says Vietnam vet on their hat, and you walk up to them and say, you're a Vietnam vet, huh? And they look at you, and they kind of coil back in horror, thinking mm-hmm. you're going to say something really awful, and just say, thank you for your service. Welcome home. Mm-hmm. It's incredible how often we've done that. I did it several months ago to a vet. And a few minutes later, his wife came up to me and said, you know, that's the first time anyone ever did that.
Wow.
And it has a significant impact.
I've never thought of those ideas. Mm-hmm. Thank you both for suggesting that.
Brandywine Flags also gives 20% off of anything veterans buy at our store. And that's our way of saying thank you to the veterans for the sacrifices they and their buddies have made for us and our country.
Well, other retailers out there, you just heard the challenge to match that. That's another way to show appreciation to vets, offer discounts. I know many do, but please feel free to email us at info@1180wfyl.com with any comments or questions about today's program. Raise the standard. Thank you for listening.